A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been staring at minimum order quantities on Alibaba and wondering what actually drives them. The surface assumption is that MOQs are about logistics. Fill a pallet, fill a container, move on. But he's asking whether that's really the dominant driver, or whether there's something deeper going on, like a supplier's appetite for dealing with smaller customers at all. And he's noticed the same product category can have MOQs ranging from 1 piece to 1,000. So the real question is, what explains that variability?
Oh, this is one of those topics where the surface answer is easy and the real answer is, every part of a business expresses itself in that number. It's like a blood pressure reading for a supplier's entire operation.
A blood pressure reading. So if my MOQ is 500, I'm hypertensive.
You might be. Or you might be running a very specific type of factory. Let me start with what most people get wrong. Daniel's instinct about logistics is partly right, but it's only one layer. The bigger forces are usually upstream of the shipping dock. For a lot of manufactured goods, the dominant cost isn't the material or the labor per unit. It's what happens before you make anything at all. If I'm producing label printer refills, I have to configure the injection molding machine, run test shots, get the plastic to the right temperature profile, dial in the tolerances. That setup time might be 2 hours whether I'm making 10 units or 10,000. If my machine time costs $200 an hour, I'm $400 in the hole before I've produced a single sellable item. If I sell you 5 units at $2 each, I just lost $390 on your order.
The MOQ is the number where you stop losing money.
It's the break-even threshold for the setup. And this varies wildly even within the same product category because different factories have different equipment, different labor costs, different levels of automation. A highly automated line in Shenzhen might have a setup cost so low that an MOQ of 1 is profitable. A semi-manual operation in a different province might need 500 units just to cover the changeover. Which explains why you see that spread for the exact same item.
Different factories, different math.
Here's where it gets more interesting. The setup cost isn't just the machine, it's also the administrative overhead. Processing a purchase order, generating an invoice, arranging shipping documentation, dealing with customs paperwork. That administrative cost is remarkably sticky. A 2023 survey by the Institute for Supply Management found that the average cost to process a single purchase order in manufacturing was around $80 to $120, regardless of order size.
If I order 3 label printer refills, someone just spent $100 to type my name into a form.
That's before they've made the thing. So you start seeing MOQs emerge not from production constraints, but from what I'd call bureaucratic floor pricing. The order has to be large enough that the admin cost becomes a rounding error.
Like when a restaurant has a minimum charge for delivery. It's not that the driver can't carry a single spring roll. It's that the economics of dispatching the driver don't work below a certain threshold.
That's exactly the right analogy, and it connects to something Daniel mentioned, quantity-based discounting and where the floor is. The floor is where the supplier's marginal cost bottoms out. For physical goods, that's usually raw materials plus the marginal labor and machine time. But the shape of that discount curve tells you a lot about where their real costs live.
If discounts are steep from 1 to 100, but flat from 1,000 to 10,000, the setup and admin costs are being amortized in that first chunk, and after that, you're basically paying for materials and runtime.
And this leads to a phenomenon I find genuinely delightful, the MOQ as a customer filtering mechanism. Sometimes the number isn't really about cost at all. It's about who you want to deal with.
This is the part where we get cynical.
I prefer realistic. A supplier who sets an MOQ of 1,000 units isn't necessarily unable to profitably sell you 50. They're signaling that they don't want 50-unit customers. Small orders mean more customer service inquiries, more hand-holding, higher return rates relative to order size, more payment friction. The MOQ is a velvet rope.
We could serve you. We choose not to.
It's perfectly rational. If you're a factory running at 80% capacity with large, reliable contract customers, taking on small buyers introduces operational complexity you don't need. Every small order is a scheduling disruption. You're interrupting a 100,000-unit production run to squeeze in someone's 500 units, which means another changeover, another setup, another quality check.
The MOQ is partly a statement about opportunity cost. The smallest order worth interrupting my existing business for is this number.
That's the core of it. And this is why MOQs shift over a supplier's lifecycle. A new factory hungry for business will set low MOQs, sometimes unsustainably low, to build a customer base and generate cash flow. An established factory with full order books will raise MOQs to shed the customers who contribute the least margin per unit of attention.
The dating strategy of industrial procurement. Flexible standards early, very selective later.
I'm not going to touch the dating analogy, but yes. And there's a third dimension beyond setup costs and customer filtering that I think is the least appreciated: raw material procurement. Most manufacturers don't buy raw materials per order. They buy in bulk, on contract, or in standard lot sizes from their own suppliers. If I'm making label printer refills, I'm probably buying plastic resin in 25-kilogram bags. If my MOQ to you is 500 units, it might be because 500 units consumes exactly one bag of resin. I don't want to open a bag, use a quarter of it, and have the rest sitting around absorbing moisture from the air.
The MOQ cascades upstream. Your supplier's minimum order to you becomes your minimum order to me.
The entire supply chain is a series of nested MOQs. The resin supplier has a minimum shipment. The packaging supplier has a minimum print run for the retail boxes. The logistics company has a minimum charge for pallet pickup. Each of these imposes a floor. And the final MOQ is the highest of those floors, or the point where they all simultaneously work.
Which brings us back to Daniel's original theory about logistics units. He wasn't wrong. The pallet and container fit is real, but it sounds like it's one constraint among many, and often not the binding one.
It's the most visible constraint, which is why people assume it's the main one. If you tour a factory, you see pallets and containers. You don't see the setup cost spreadsheet or the customer segmentation strategy. For some goods, logistics is the dominant driver. If you're selling something bulky and cheap like industrial insulation, the shipping cost per cubic meter can exceed the manufacturing cost. In that case, the MOQ is absolutely about filling a container because shipping a half-empty container costs almost the same as shipping a full one.
The hierarchy is, for high value, compact goods, setup and admin dominate. For low value, bulky goods, logistics dominates. And for everything else, it's a negotiation among multiple constraints.
That's the framework. But I want to add one more layer that's changed dramatically in the last decade, the platform effect.
Alibaba and its relatives.
Platforms like Alibaba have fundamentally altered what MOQ means because they've aggregated demand in ways that didn't exist before. A supplier who would have needed an MOQ of 500 when they had to find each customer individually can now set an MOQ of 50 because the platform brings them 100 small customers with near zero acquisition cost.
The platform absorbs the customer filtering function. The supplier doesn't need the MOQ to screen out small buyers because the platform is doing the screening through search and reputation algorithms.
The administrative cost drops too. Alibaba standardizes the purchase order, the payment processing, the messaging. What was $100 administrative overhead per order becomes $10 of platform fees. Suddenly, that 50-unit order is profitable. The MOQ can drop without the underlying manufacturing economics changing at all.
Which explains something I've noticed. The same supplier will often have a lower MOQ on their Alibaba storefront than if you contact them directly. It's not a different product. It's a different cost structure for the transaction layer.
In classical procurement theory, MOQ is a production economics number. In modern practice, it's increasingly a transaction economics number. The cost of making the thing hasn't changed much. The cost of selling the thing has been transformed.
If I'm a small buyer trying to understand why a particular MOQ is what it is, what should I be looking at?
First, look at the product itself. Is it made to order or made to stock? Made to order goods almost always have higher MOQs because the setup cost is incurred specifically for your order. made to stock goods can have MOQs of 1 because the setup was already amortized across the entire production run. Second, look at the degree of customization. A standard label printer refill, off the shelf, no branding, should have a low MOQ because the supplier can aggregate demand across many customers. A refill with your company's logo printed on it? Now you're paying for a print plate setup, a separate production run, separate inventory tracking. The MOQ jumps because you're no longer sharing the setup cost with anyone.
The MOQ is the price of uniqueness.
And third, look at the supplier's geography and target market. A supplier in a low-cost region selling primarily to domestic wholesalers will have an MOQ calibrated to that market's norms. The same supplier listing on a global platform might set a different MOQ for international buyers because international shipping changes the economics. You now have customs brokerage, freight forwarding, and longer payment cycles to account for.
The MOQ isn't just a number. It's a text you can read if you know the language.
That's exactly what I'm arguing. Every MOQ is a compressed expression of the supplier's cost structure, market position, operational maturity, and strategic intent. Skilled procurement people learn to read it like a financial statement.
Which brings me to a question. If I'm a buyer and I see an MOQ I don't like, what's actually negotiable?
Almost everything, under the right conditions. But you have to understand what you're negotiating against. If the MOQ is driven by setup cost, you can offer to pay a setup fee instead of meeting the quantity. The supplier gets their fixed cost covered, you get your 50 units, everyone's happy.
You're unbundling the MOQ, paying for the setup explicitly rather than having it amortized across units.
If the MOQ is driven by raw material lot sizes, you might be able to pay a premium for the broken lot. The supplier opens the bag, uses what you need, and charges you extra for the material waste and handling. If the MOQ is driven by logistics, you might offer to arrange your own shipping or consolidate your order with another buyer's.
If it's driven by the velvet rope factor, the supplier just doesn't want small customers.
Then you're probably not going to negotiate your way around it, and you shouldn't try. A supplier who doesn't want your business will make you pay for that reluctance in ways that go beyond the MOQ. Slower response times, lower priority in production scheduling, less flexibility on quality issues. The MOQ is doing you a favor by telling you up front that you're not their target customer.
The honest rejection is a gift.
It really is. A lot of small buyers see a high MOQ as an obstacle to overcome, when sometimes it's a signal to find a different supplier whose business model actually fits their order profile.
Let's talk about the other side of this. Daniel mentioned quantity-based discounting and the point where an item can't be discounted further. Where is that floor and what determines it?
The floor is the sum of costs that can't be eliminated regardless of volume. Raw materials, the marginal energy cost of production, the marginal labor, and any per unit fees like payment processing or platform commissions. You can't discount below that without losing money on every unit. But here's what's interesting. That floor is often lower than most buyers think, because many costs that feel variable are actually fixed or semi-fixed.
Give me an example.
Whether you order 100 units or 100,000, the supplier's lease payment doesn't change. Equipment depreciation is mostly time-based, not unit-based. The quality control manager's salary is the same. So as volume increases, these fixed costs get spread thinner and thinner. The marginal cost of unit 10,000 is lower than the marginal cost of unit 100, not because anything got cheaper to make, but because the fixed costs are fully absorbed.
Which is why the discount curve is steepest at the low end and flattens out. Once you've covered the fixed costs, additional units just cost whatever the materials and direct labor cost.
That asymptote, the flat part at the end, is what procurement people call the should cost. It's what the product would cost to produce in a world with no overhead, no setup, no profit margin. If you know the should cost, you know how much room there is to negotiate.
How do you figure out the should cost if you're not the manufacturer?
You reverse engineer it. You look at the bill of materials, what's in the thing, what do those raw materials cost on commodity markets, and you estimate the labor and machine time based on the manufacturing process. It's not perfect, but it gives you a baseline. For a label printer refill, you're looking at a few cents of plastic resin, maybe 10 cents of ink or thermal transfer ribbon, and a few seconds of machine time. The should cost might be 20 or 30 cents. If you're paying $2 a unit at low volumes, that difference is almost entirely setup, overhead, and margin.
The MOQ of $500 at $2 a unit is really saying, I need $1,000 of revenue on this order to make it worth my while, and I don't care whether that's 500 units at $2 or 1,000 units at $1.
You've just articulated the concept of the minimum order value, which is the hidden twin of the MOQ. A lot of suppliers don't actually care about the unit count. They care about the total revenue and margin on the order. The MOQ in pieces is just a shorthand for an order that generates at least X dollars of contribution margin. That's why you can sometimes negotiate the MOQ down if you're buying a higher value item from the same supplier. They'll waive the piece count because the dollar threshold is met.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, the platform effect and how it's changed. MOQs. Has this been measured?
There's been some research. A 2024 paper in the Journal of International Business Studies looked at MOQ trends on B2B platforms and found that the average MOQ for consumer electronics on Alibaba dropped by about 40% between 2015 and 2023, adjusting for product category. The authors attributed most of that decline to platform-driven reductions in transaction costs, not to changes in manufacturing efficiency.
40% is enormous. That's not marginal tinkering. That's a structural shift.
It's probably understated, because the composition of products on the platform changed over that period too. As MOQs dropped, entirely new categories of buyers entered the market. Small e-commerce sellers, hobbyists, businesses in developing countries that previously couldn't access global supply chains at all. The demand curve itself shifted.
The platform didn't just reduce MOQs for existing buyers. It created a whole new class of buyer whose existence depends on low MOQs.
That's created a bifurcation in manufacturing. You now have factories that specialize in high MOQ, low mix production for large corporate buyers, and factories that specialize in low MOQ, high mix production for platform buyers. They're almost different industries, even when they're making similar products.
Different equipment, different workforce, different culture.
The high MOQ factory is optimized for efficiency and consistency. Long runs, minimal changeovers, statistical process control tuned for a single product. The low MOQ factory is optimized for flexibility. Quick change tooling, cross-trained workers, scheduling software that can handle 50 different SKUs in a week. The low MOQ factory has higher unit costs, but captures more margin per unit because they're serving customers who can't access the high MOQ alternative.
It's the difference between a freight train and a fleet of delivery vans. Same basic function, completely different operating model.
Here's where things get strategically interesting. Some large manufacturers are now running both models under one roof. They'll have a high-volume line for their contract customers and a flexible short-run line for platform orders. The short-run line is less profitable per unit, but it serves as a market intelligence function. They see what small, innovative buyers are ordering, spot trends early, and use that information to inform their large-volume product development.
The low MOQ business is partly a listening post.
A listening post that happens to break even or make a small profit. It's brilliant, and it's something that purely high MOQ competitors can't replicate easily because they don't have the operational flexibility.
Let me play devil's advocate on the platform story. You said MOQs dropped 40% on Alibaba. But anyone who's actually used Alibaba knows there are still plenty of listings with absurd MOQs. Like 5,000 units for something that's clearly a sample size product. What's happening there?
Sometimes it's a listing that's not really meant for platform sales. The supplier has the listing up for visibility, but their actual business is offline with large contract customers. The high MOQ is a polite way of saying contact us for real business. This listing is a billboard, not a store.
Like a restaurant that technically has a menu online, but only does catering.
Other times, the high MOQ is inventory signaling. The supplier doesn't actually have the product in stock and doesn't want to manufacture it unless the order is large enough to justify a production run. The listing is testing demand. If someone actually places an order for 5,000 units, they'll make them. If not, the listing sits there costing almost nothing.
It's a free option on demand.
An extremely cheap one, given that platform listing fees are negligible. And then there's a third category that's less benign, MOQs that exist because of information asymmetry. The supplier knows that some percentage of buyers don't understand MOQs, don't negotiate, and will either pay the high MOQ or go away. The MOQ is set high not because of costs, but because of expected buyer behavior.
The greater fool theory of procurement.
It's not quite that harsh, but close. And this is why I always tell people, if you see an MOQ that makes no sense for the product, ask about it. A surprising number of listings have MOQs that the salesperson will waive immediately when you contact them. The number was set by someone in a different department, or it was a default in the listing software, or it was set years ago and never updated.
The organizational inertia theory of MOQs.
Which is probably the most common theory of all, if we're being honest. I'd estimate, and this is a Herman estimate, not a peer-reviewed one, that maybe a third of the MOQs you encounter on platforms are artifacts rather than active business decisions. Someone said it once and nobody's revisited it.
A Herman estimate? We should trademark that.
It comes with a warranty of 0% accuracy and 100% conviction.
Let's shift to something practical. Daniel's prompt implies he's a buyer encountering these numbers. What's the actual playbook? You walk onto Alibaba, you find a product, the MOQ is 500, you want 50. What do you do?
Step 1, message the supplier. I'm interested in your product, but my initial order would be 50 units. Is that possible? And what would the pricing look like? You'd be shocked how often the answer is, yes, 50 units at X price, where X is maybe 20 or 30% higher than the 500 unit price.
The listed MOQ isn't even real a lot of the time.
It's an opening bid in a negotiation that most buyers don't realize they're in. Step 2, if the supplier says no or the price is too high, ask about samples. Many suppliers have a separate sample program with an MOQ of 1 to 5 units. The sample price will be high per unit, but you're not buying inventory. You're buying the relationship and the chance to inspect quality.
Once you've bought samples, you're no longer a stranger. You're a returning customer, even if the first order was tiny.
The psychology matters enormously here. A supplier who won't bend the MOQ for a cold inquiry from an unknown buyer might be much more flexible for someone who's already completed a transaction, left a good review, and demonstrated they're serious. If the supplier is firm on MOQ, ask whether they have overstock, last season's model, or a cosmetically imperfect batch they'd sell in smaller quantities. This doesn't work for every product category, but for consumer goods, apparel, and electronics accessories, it's surprisingly effective. The supplier has inventory they want to move, and small orders of clearance items are better than no orders.
The TJ Maxx strategy applied to industrial procurement.
I'm going to start a consulting firm called Procurement Max and make millions. Step 4, consolidation. Find a few other buyers who want the same product and place a combined order. This is harder for an individual, but there are services and communities that facilitate it. Some Alibaba suppliers will even help. They'll let you place a small order that gets batched with other small orders until the combined quantity hits the MOQ, at which point they run production.
That's clever. The supplier effectively becomes their own demand aggregator.
It's a model that's growing. There are third-party logistics companies now that specialize in exactly this. They'll hold inventory from multiple small buyers, combine orders to hit supplier MOQs, and then split the shipment at their warehouse. You pay a small premium for the service, but it's often cheaper than buying at the high per-unit price of a below-MOQ order.
The ecosystem is evolving to fill the gap between what buyers want to order and what suppliers want to sell.
That's the big story. The gap between buyer preferences and supplier economics has always existed. What's changed is the number and sophistication of intermediaries willing to profit from bridging that gap. Platforms, consolidators, sample forwarding services, inspection companies that will check quality on tiny orders. The whole infrastructure of small-scale global trade has been built out in the last decade.
Which makes me wonder, are MOQs going to keep trending downward? Is there a flaw?
There's definitely a floor, and it's different for different product categories. For goods that can be made on demand with digital manufacturing, think 3D printing, CNC machining, laser cutting, the MOQ floor is basically one. The setup cost is near zero because the machine just reads a digital file. We're seeing this in industrial parts, custom enclosures, even some medical devices.
For anything that can be digitally manufactured, MOQ eventually goes to one.
But for goods that require tooling, injection molding, die casting, stamping, The MOQ floor is much higher and will stay higher because the physics of tooling haven't changed. A mold costs what it costs. You can amortize it over more units, but you can't eliminate it.
Unless someone figures out how to 3D print injection molds that last long enough.
Which people are working on, by the way. Printed toolin is a real thing now for short-run production. You can 3D print a mold insert that lasts for a few hundred shots, which is enough for a low MOQ order. It's not as durable as a machined steel mold, but it costs a fraction as much and can be made in hours rather than weeks.
The low MOQ factory of the future might not have a tool room at all. Just a room full of 3D printers making disposable molds.
That's already happening in some sectors. The dental industry, for example, clear aligners are made using 3D printed molds that are used once and discarded. The MOQ for a custom dental product is literally one, because every patient's mouth is different and the digital manufacturing pipeline handles it without any setup penalty.
I hadn't made that connection. Custom medical devices are the ultimate low MOQ product, and they're enabled by exactly the technologies that will eventually bring MOQs down for everything else.
The trajectory is clear. MOQs are a function of setup costs, and setup costs are being systematically attacked by digital manufacturing, platform automation, and logistics innovation. The MOQ of 2026 is lower than the MOQ of 2016, and the MOQ of 2036 will be lower still.
Not zero for most things. There will always be goods where the economics demand a minimum batch.
And that's not a problem to be solved. It's just a feature of physical reality. What's changing is which goods fall into which bucket. 50 years ago, almost everything had a high MOQ relative to today. 50 years from now, the high MOQ bucket will be much smaller, but it won't be empty.
I want to loop back to something from earlier. The idea that MOQs can be read as a text. If you're a buyer, what are the specific things you should look for in an MOQ that tell you something about the supplier beyond just the number?
First, compare the MOQ to the product's unit value. A high MOQ on a low-value product usually signals logistics-driven constraints. A high MOQ on a high-value product usually signals either customization requirements or a supplier who specializes in large contract customers. Second, look at the gap between the MOQ and the next price break quantity. If the MOQ is 500 and the next price break is at 1,000, that's a supplier who expects most orders to cluster around those 2 points. If the MOQ is 500 and the next price break is at 10,000, the supplier is really a large volume producer who's offering the 500 MOQ as a courtesy or a market testing mechanism.
The shape of the discount schedule is a market positioning document.
It absolutely is. Third, look at whether the MOQ varies by product variant. If a supplier has an MOQ of 500 for black label printer refills but 1,000 for the red ones, that tells you something about their production volumes by SKU. The black ones sell in higher volume, so they're produced more frequently and the setup cost is shared across more customers. The red ones are a slower moving item, so you're paying for a larger share of the setup.
Which is useful intelligence if you're willing to be flexible on color. Buy the black ones at the lower MOQ.
Procurement is just applied flexibility. The more dimensions you're willing to flex on, the better your outcomes. Color, timing, packaging, payment terms. Each one is a lever that can move the MOQ.
The ultimate MOQ negotiation strategy isn't about haggling. It's about understanding which constraints are binding and offering to relax a different constraint in exchange.
That's the advanced class, and it's what separates professional buyers from amateurs. The amateur sees an MOQ and thinks, "How do I get this number lower?" The professional sees an MOQ and thinks, "What is this number telling me about the supplier's constraints, and what can I offer that addresses those constraints more efficiently than a high-volume commitment?"
Sometimes the answer is nothing. This supplier's constraints and your needs are incompatible, and the right move is to walk away.
Which is itself a valuable outcome. Knowing not to do a deal is just as important as knowing how to do one.
All right, we've covered the theory. Let's do a quick practical summary for someone who's staring at an MOQ right now and trying to make sense of it. What's the checklist?
First, identify what's driving it. Setup cost, raw material lot sizes, logistics, customer filtering, or platform artifact. Second, determine whether it's real. Message, the supplier, and ask. Third, if it's real, figure out what you can offer in exchange for flexibility, higher per unit price, different product variant, flexible timing, consolidated payment, whatever. Fourth, if none of that works, look for intermediaries, consolidators, samples programs, alternative suppliers with different business models. Fifth, accept that some MOQs are telling you the truth about incompatibility and thank them for the honesty.
That's a solid framework. And I think the overarching point, the thing I'm taking away from this, is that MOQs look like simple numbers, but they're actually compressed narratives. They're a story about how a supplier makes money, who they want to do business with, and where their operational pain points live.
And once you learn to read those stories, procurement stops being about price comparison and starts being about strategic matchmaking. You're not just buying a product, you're finding a supplier whose business model aligns with your needs.
The dating app model of industrial sourcing.
I knew you'd find a way to bring dating into this.
Swipe right for low MOQ.
I'm not swiping anything. I'm a retired pediatrician.
With a DJ side hustle. You're basically a dating app already.
There's one more dimension I want to touch on. The role of MOQs in risk allocation. An MOQ isn't just about cost recovery. It's also about who bears the risk of unsold inventory. If a supplier makes 500 units for you and you only sell 200, who's stuck with the rest? If the supplier sets an MOQ, they're ensuring that even if you only sell a fraction, they've still moved enough volume to cover their costs. If there's no MOQ and you order 10 units, the supplier is bearing almost no inventory risk, but they're also making almost no money. The MOQ is the point where the risk-reward trade-off makes sense for the supplier.
A high MOQ is partly the supplier saying, "I'll take the production risk, but you take the demand risk."
And in some industries, MOQs are explicitly structured as risk transfer mechanisms. Fashion, for example, a clothing manufacturer might set a high MOQ, not because the garments are expensive to make, but because fashion demand is unpredictable and they want the buyer to have skin in the game. If you're committed to 1,000 units, you're going to work harder to sell them than if you ordered 50.
The MOQ as commitment device.
Which is a concept from behavioral economics that shows up all over procurement. People value things they're committed to. High MOQs create committed buyers, and committed buyers are better partners in the long run. They pay on time, they communicate proactively, they don't disappear when a cheaper supplier appears.
There's a relationship quality argument for high MOQs that has nothing to do with unit economics.
And this is why some suppliers will actually reject orders that are too large from new buyers. If you've never bought from them before and you want 100,000 units, alarm bells go off. Are you going to pay? Are you going to return half the order? Are you a competitor trying to tie up their capacity? The MOQ isn't just a floor. There's sometimes an implicit ceiling too, at least for initial orders.
The maximum order quantity is the MOQ's neglected twin.
It's rarely stated explicitly, but it's absolutely a thing in practice. New buyer, huge order, no track record. That's not an opportunity, that's a risk.
This has been useful. I feel like I could walk onto Alibaba right now and read the listings like a procurement analyst.
You'd probably negotiate better than 90% of buyers just by understanding what's behind the numbers. The bar is not high.
The bar is on the floor, and there's an MOQ to step over it.
500 steps minimum.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, an Eaton Fives court at the British Embassy in Mali measured 28 feet by 13 feet, roughly the same footprint as a Soviet-era Lada parked sideways in a diplomatic carport.
I now know the dimensions of a sport I didn't know existed, in a context I can't use. So where does this leave us? I think the big open question is whether AI procurement tools, which are becoming sophisticated, will change MOQ dynamics further. If an AI can negotiate with 1,000 suppliers simultaneously, aggregate demand across multiple buyers, and optimize orders in real time, what happens to the traditional MOQ?
The MOQ becomes a parameter in an optimization algorithm rather than a human-readable business signal.
That might be a loss. We talked about reading MOQs as text. If the reading is done by machines negotiating with machines, that layer of meaning, the strategic intent, the relationship signaling, gets stripped out. You're left with pure price and quantity optimization.
Which is efficient, but maybe a little sad, like replacing a handwritten letter with a form email.
The procurement equivalent of losing the art of conversation. Something to think about for a future episode, maybe.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the lights on and the fun facts inexplicable. You can find us at My Weird Prompts.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more than you'd think.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.